Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, good food and complicated families, just in time for Thanksgiving. We'll sample creative and colorful recipes for vegans, known for their holiday meal humbuggery, with nary a tofurkey in sight. We'll also get a book blogger's tips on what to pack for a long weekend with relatives. But first, to the food. There are few surprises on the Thanksgiving table, and maybe that's the point. It's not really the time for experimenting with new dishes. So here, with some ideas for making the old-school Thanksgiving favorites even more delicious, is J.M. Hirsch. He's food editor at the Associated Press and author of the high-flavor, low-labor cookbook, as well as one of our favorite blogs, Lunchbox Blues. Today, however, J.M. is going to talk with us about, I'll just let you say it.
I'm going to give you my top 12 tips for pimping your Thanksgiving dinner.
Pimping?
Pimp the Thanksgiving dinner. You know, okay, well, here's the thing. Everybody loves tradition. You know, that's why we gather around the table. Okay, but there are so many easy ways to take average and make it extraordinary without leaving tradition behind.
You know, part of Thanksgiving, of course, is psychological. It's the sort of looking forward to or dreading, perhaps, the onslaught of work.
Right. And, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, we do get ourselves psyched up. I mean, you start getting the magazines in September and October with all the gorgeous, luxurious turkeys and all the sides and the covers and everything. And you can totally psych yourself up. But the reality is, if you just do a basic roast of a basic good quality turkey and you put just a little bit of effort into it, nothing fancy. I mean, we're talking butter and herbs here. You're going to get a great result without having to stress over it.
Okay, let's start with the basics.
All right, so we're going to start with the turkey.
Okay.
How often do you make a turkey?
Once a year.
Exactly. All right, so this is the time to splurge. Buy a good bird, okay? Don't go buy your bargain basement bird. Get a fresh turkey, an organic turkey, an heirloom one. You're going to taste the difference. It's worth the extra money. You know, I think it's probably $1 more per pound. It's going to be totally worth it.
Okay, and now do you brine or do you not brine?
I do brine in that point, number two. But you're going to pimp your brine, all right? So what you're going to do is a one-to-one ratio of salt and brown sugar, and then you're going to throw in some apple cider instead of water. And then you're going to throw in a little bit of black pepper, some fresh rosemary, mix it all together, you know, let it sit in the refrigerator for 8 hours, up to 72 hours, then you rinse it off and you roast it.
So you've brined your organic turkey then?
Then, okay, now we're going to roast it. Now, don't just pop it in the oven. What you want to do is lube that sucker up with as much butter as you can. Get it right under the skin very carefully. Just kind of lift the skin and squeegee your hand under there. While you're in there, throw some herbs under the skin as well. Now, the cavity, not meant for stuffing. That's why casserole dishes were invented, okay? So you're going to fill the cavity with more fresh herbs. Really get huge clumps of them. Jam them in there. Slice up a few onions, garlic, some lemons, but save the stuffing for the casserole dish.
All this pimping is very much upsetting my sensibilities.
But you know what? It's all easy, right? This is stuff anybody
can do. You're
right.
This is not a Martha Stewart.
All right. Based. Do it. Just don't do it more than every 30 minutes, because if you do it more than every 30 minutes, you're going to take you until Christmas to roast your bird, okay? But definitely do it, because you want to get
really from the beginning 30
flowing.
Minutes or get it going?
Yeah, let it go
bit.
For about an hour and then start, and about every 30 minutes. But you got to let the heat get in there. All right, now, the sides. My number one rule is you need to know where to spend money and you need to know where to spend time, okay? Now, you got to judge for yourself. I am not an amazing bread baker, so I don't bake my own bread. I buy really good rolls from a local bakery, and I serve those. I, however, make really good butter from scratch, and that's something anybody can do. Seriously, it takes you 5 minutes with a food processor.
I'm gobsmacked right now.
Okay, all you do, you get some heavy cream. Get a quart of heavy cream. Dump it in a food processor. Turn the food processor on. Let it go until it turns into whipped cream. Then let it go for a few more minutes, and all of a sudden, you're going to get huge clumps of butter and buttermilk. Drain off the buttermilk, and you've got butter. That's it. Then add some seasonings to it, some salt, maybe some black pepper, whatever gets you going, and you have fresh homemade butter in 5 minutes.
Okay, that's very pilgrim-like.
Now, that is something anybody can do that's going to impress people on the table, but didn't take you a whole lot of time or effort or money, for that matter.
So, all right, I'm with you. Keep
going. Spend time, spend money. Know where your strengths are. Okay, next up, mashed potatoes. Dry potatoes are better potatoes. So, after you boil your potatoes, drain them, then dump them on, before you mash them, dump them onto a baking sheet. Pop that into a 350, 400 degree oven for 5 or 10 minutes just to dry them out a little bit. Pull them out of the oven, put them back in the pan, and then mash them and add, you know, as much butter as you can possibly add and milk and whatever else you like. All right, next up, salad. Don't do it. Okay?
Always have the bowl of salad sitting there at Thanksgiving and nobody touches it.
First of all, nobody wants it and nobody eats it. All right. Don't complicate your life. Don't complicate your bird by stuffing the bird with stuffing. All right. We've already put herbs and lemons and all that stuff in there. The other thing you want to do for your stuffing is make it from scratch. And it's so easy. All right. Earlier in the week, buy some really good quality bread, whatever type of bread you like, sourdough, challah, whatever you like. All right. Open the bag, let it sit on the counter for a few days until it goes stale. Cut it up, throw it in the oven, toast it. Then you're going to mix it up with some dried fruit so you get some nice contrast of taste and texture, so maybe some dried cherries, some dried cranberries, some apricots. And then you're going to throw in some onions and some sage, some celery, an egg or two, whatever. Mix it all up, throw it in an oil or buttered casserole dish, and bake it, and you're done.
Okay, all right. but you know, I guess the argument is that if you put it inside of the bird, it gets all the nice juices of the bird.
Nothing stopping you from scooping some of those juices out and drizzling them right over, if that's what you want.
You're winning me over to the pimpin' lifestyle.
You know, and when you're doing your 30-minute basting, you know, scoop a little bit out and drizzle it over your stuffing.
Okay, so after all this, I'm not imagining that you would open a can of that jellied cranberry sauce and let it come out in the goop.
Personally speaking, I think all cranberry sauce is wonderful, whether it comes from a can or not. However, I do make my own. All you do, use the recipe that's on the bag. But it's so easy to pimp it. Add some golden raisins, add some dried cherries, some dried cranberries, a fresh chopped up pear, maybe an apple chopped up, throw in some spices, some cinnamon, some cardamom, some allspice, maybe a little bit of nutmeg, all that sort of stuff. The point is, it's going to take you 5 minutes and the difference is going to be tremendous. Now we're going to move on to the green veggies. When in doubt, add bacon, okay? You know, we all know bacon makes everything better. And the reality is, when it comes to green veggies at the Thanksgiving table, very few people vary beyond green beans and Brussels sprouts.
Right.
But what you want to do is roast them, because that's going to caramelize the natural sugars in the veggies. It's going to make them all yummy. And then if you add some nice fat and some crunch from the bacon, it's going to be very good.
So you roast first, then add bacon?
You can roast them all together if you like.
Okay.
And all right.
You're dealing with, you know, somebody who pretends every Thanksgiving that she knows what she's doing, but I'm hanging on to your every word.
All right, next up is the orange veggies. And, you know, we're pretty much talking about sweet potatoes and butternut squash. Leave the mashing to the white potatoes. Instead, what you want to do with the orange veggies is cut them up, dust them with cornstarch and whatever other herbs or seasonings you like, and then roast them.
What does the cornstarch do?
Cornstarch helps caramelize the sugars and gives you that nice crunchy exterior. And so because you want contrast here. Let's face it. This meal is all about carbs and fat, right? So we want to make sure we have some contrast between the different dishes. And so if you're going to have mashed
some crunchy
white,
fat.
Some crunchy fat, exactly. Some soft fat. You know, that's what the mashed potatoes are for. And so we want to make sure that we have a really good, you know, nice crunch, nice caramelized exterior on the orange veggies. So just a little bit of cornstarch, whatever seasonings you like. Toss it all together with a bit of olive oil or something. Throw it on a sheet pan and roast it. And you're done. All right, the pie, finally. Once again, unless you won the bake-off competition, this is where you spend your money instead of your time.
Uh-huh.
I suck at making pie, so I don't do it, okay? So I buy really good pies. Now, what I can make, however, going back to the butter, I can make really good whipped cream in about a minute. And I can spike that whipped cream with maybe some vanilla bean, a bit of powdered sugar, maybe some cinnamon, Grand Marnier. That same whipped cream not only goes on the pie that you purchased, it can also go on the coffee that you serve with the pie.
Wow. So all of this is sounding very manageable. The pimpin' lifestyle is not as tough as you might think.
It's so easy. Just doing little things to the stuff you're already doing is going to make a huge difference in what you end up putting on the table.
Let me ask you, on Thanksgiving, are you doing all this? Do you do this collectively?
Most of it. My wife generally does the turkey, but I will tell you, I have zero interest in turkey at Thanksgiving.
No kidding.
My family, we're not Greek, but for whatever reason, my family's traditional centerpiece at the Thanksgiving table is a gigantic spanakopita. So we also do a turkey, because my wife's family prefers turkey.
Well, you know, there's a lot of room for blended families, the Indians, the pilgrims,
etc.,
etc. Well, we'll make sure to put some tips from JM on our website at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
J.M. Hirsch is food editor at the Associated Press and author of a cookbook that really speaks our language, High Flavor, Low Labor. Today, though, he's kind of the Jay-Z of the kitchen. And you can see some of his tips on Big Pimpin' Your Thanksgiving Table at wordofmouthradio.org. We'd also love to hear from you. Any tricks to making your go-to Thanksgiving dishes a little more impressive? Are you a cavity stuffer holdout? Would you make your own butter? Do you secretly wish to have the whole thing catered? Join the conversation happening right now on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, Thanksgiving for vegans that we promise will not be a buzzkill. We'll take a bite of that when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Don't ask me why, but I did attend a vegan Thanksgiving a few years ago, and I remember a kind of grayish mock turkey and washing down cookies that tasted kind of like sawdust with twig tea, and wondering, why would anyone consider this a celebration? Vegan food has made great strides since, but it still feels like a bit of a downer to insist upon being a vegan at Thanksgiving. That is, unless you're talking to Robin Asbell. She's a chef, a food writer, and cooking teacher specializing in natural foods, whose book Big Vegan is a lively, colorful, and yes, big book of meat and dairy-free recipes for confirmed vegans, and even for those who've been on the wrong side of a finger-wagging vegan in the past.
Well, I suppose that if you've met one vegan who lectured you, you might sort of put us all in the same basket. But I think more and more, you know, we're kind of opening up to the idea that more and more people can be vegan-ish or mostly vegan or leaning into vegan or kind of vegan, and it's okay.
What exactly is your definition of vegan food?
Well, vegan just basically means there's no meat, no eggs, no dairy, you know, no animal foods, no fish. Some people will go further and, you know, not wear leather shoes, or there's an issue with sugar. Mostly it's just, you know, leaving the animals out.
Well, I'd love to get into some of the recipes. First of all, I did make a couple recipes. I did the apple cider glazed carrots.
It must have been delicious.
And what's the other one I made? I made a fettuccine with mushrooms that was really good. And I thought I marked
the triple mushroom.
Oh, yeah. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I invented that one in part as an exercise in using umami.
Tell me about that, umami, because you say in working with the basics of vegan cooking, you look to balancing the five tastes. Give us the basics on that, and of course, umami comes into play.
So, you know, we have the four tastes, you know, hot, sour, salty, sweet, but the fifth taste is umami, and that's sort of a new concept in this country. They've been talking about it in Japan for centuries, but basically, it's a meaty sensation. It's a meaty quality, a mouth-filling quality. And it comes from certain amino acids and certain chemicals, which are, of course, in meat, but they're also in plant foods. So the recipe you're talking about, I used dried mushrooms and two kinds of fresh mushrooms and some nutritional yeast and tomato paste and wine, which are all big umami builders.
One of the things that I got nervous about is nutritional yeast, but it is the kind of mock stuff that I am wary of. How do you use that?
Nutritional yeast, it's not active in any way. It's not going to rise or do anything like that. It's basically just high in B12 and really high in protein. And it's something that was kind of created for vegans back in the 70s. But it's very high in this umami. And I understand that when I'm starting out with people on vegan food, we try to stick with things that are just familiar foods, like, you know, beans and nuts and seeds. So if you want to, you can just leave it out. But it's kind of cheesy tasting, and it adds that meaty quality to foods.
Speaking of cheesy tasting, I am so excited about trying cashew chèvre.
Yes, and, you know, that is something I'm just hooked on. Living without dairy cheese, which a lot of people will come to me and say, I just cannot give up cheese. This is really a very good solution. And it's basically you soak raw cashews and puree them, and you can ferment them a little with some acidophilus, as I do in the book, and then just sort of flavor them up, you know, with a little acid, you know, a little lemon, a little salt. And it makes this creamy spread that when you're in a pinch, you can put that on your bagel, you can toss it with your pasta, you can put it on your pizza, You can make nachos with it, and it sort of rings those cheesy bells.
Of course, it's Thanksgiving week, and people are thinking a lot about food, a lot about bounty, a lot about, wow, how much food they might eat. Are you cooking on Thanksgiving?
Actually, this weekend, I'm going to go to an all-vegan Thanksgiving potluck. I've got a homemade seitan mock turkey roast that I make in the book, which, believe it or not, is really good.
All right, convince me.
If you've ever heard of tofurkey, it's kind of my version of tofurkey, which is a really popular turkey-like object, which is it's really quite tasty. It's got a lot of umami, and it's got a meaty texture, and it's got stuffing in it. And so I made a version of that that I think is a little bit more tender, and it's just a lot of fun for vegans to have something that's kind of a centerpiece like that that they can carve a slice off of.
Okay, so you're sitting around with your family at Thanksgiving dinner, and you have your homemade seitan mock turkey in the middle, you know, maybe being carved. Not quite the Norman Rockwell sort of picture, but tell us what's on our plate right in front of us on Thanksgiving.
I often write on and talk to people about blended Thanksgivings. I still go to people's homes who are serving turkey. I mean, I realize most of the people that I know and love do still eat turkey. And so we just, you know, bring and share. And I find that the less said, the better, especially on Thanksgiving Day. It's not the day to preach. But for the vegans, when we're especially at a shared meal, all you really have to do is just add a little bit of heft to what would be traditional side dishes, because those are the things we miss. Sweet potatoes and wild rice and stuffing and Brussels sprouts and glazed yams and... So it's kind of the gamut of everything.
Are you on any kind of mission to convert people to veganism?
I'd like everybody to eat more plants. I'd like if people would consider eating vegan sometimes. I'd like vegan options to become normal.
Thank you so much, Robin Asbell, for giving us some tempting ideas for a slightly different kind of Thanksgiving. Really appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome anytime.
Robin Asbell, chef, cooking teacher, and author of Big Vegan. You'll find more on the book, and you can weigh in on whether you could do Thanksgiving without meat, dairy, or any of the things vegans avoid at our always omnivorous website, wordofmouthradio.org, or on our Facebook page. And now to the sweet finale for good eating. A friend recently told me that I must try the drinking chocolate at Dancing Lion Chocolate in Manchester, New Hampshire. Well, that was enough for me. And then I learned that the proprietor, Richard Tango Lowy, was a physicist before becoming a chocolatier. Turns out that after experimenting on his own, Richard attended a prestigious school in France and then opened the tiny shop and cafe in Manchester. I visited him for a tasting and got a tour of Richard's kitchen. It's a laboratory of sorts for exploring the science and dark mystery of chocolate.
We try to bring our customers back to the origin of cacao, which is 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. In most of the history and in most of the world, people don't eat chocolate. They drink it. Our byline is chocolate is art. And my approach to art is it's temporary. You see it, you put it in your mouth, you taste it, and then it's gone. And I think you do that with any art. And I think we just take that to an extreme. Chocolate is very, very difficult to do really, really well. It's the temperature, the humidity, that particular chocolate, whether you're in a nice, solid, zen-like state that day or not, everything comes into play to get a really beautiful temper. What we're doing is we're melting it to a very high point, to where it's almost burnt, and then we are working it on the slab in a particular way to get it to form 5 crystals, which are stable. And over time, if we do that really well, they will turn into even more stable, form 6. And when you take a bar of chocolate that's really good and you snap it and it goes crack like a window breaking, that is a beautifully tempered piece of chocolate. Lots of form 6 crystals there. When you work the chocolate on the slab to crystal it, it's by feel and by sight and by smell, all those things. You're feeling, how is it starting to become viscous? How is it work? Where is it in its state of crystallization? In a way, it's very spiritual for us. And in a way, what we try to bring our customers outside eating the chocolate is a bit of what we experience in the kitchen when we work.
That's the physicist turned chocolatier Richard Tango Lowy. And just a tease from a longer story that we're putting together from my visit to Dancing Lion Chocolate, which if I were to summarize, would pretty much sound like this.
Wow.
Mmm, that is delicious.
Oh my God.
Wowie.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Super fruity plum.
I have to put down my microphone.
Well, that was my first tasting experience.
Yep, it was very, very good.
Well, enough of food. We're on to family next with a filmmaker who chronicled his journey home to uncover a long-held secret. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
The word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word,
word
of mouth.
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Every family has its secrets, few compared to the Lichtais. Steve Lichtai was adopted by a devout Roman Catholic family. Growing up in a small house on a Kansas farm, he was adored by his eight older siblings, adored and sheltered from a painful secret about his identity. And everyone in their small town knew the truth before he did.
Well, I always assumed that you already knew, because the kids, our kids, would have told him. Oh. Well, that's strange.
Never
I can't
knew.
Believe they kept a secret like that for
well,
so long.
And not only did they keep a secret, this is a small community. It was an open secret.
That's Steve talking to Don and Mary Jane Lichtai, the mother and father who raised him. Steve is a producer for NPR and now filmmaker. His documentary, Open Secret, chronicles his journey home to talk with his family and childhood friends about what they knew all along. Steve, thanks for joining us on Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So you had a pretty normal Midwestern childhood. Did you always know you were adopted?
Yeah, I did. When I was around 5 or 6, my parents set me down and said that we adopted you. And that was really the last of the discussion of that. I don't remember asking a lot of questions about it, but I know that I did, but I don't think it was something that was constantly on my mind. But it was definitely part of my history.
This film is your exploration of the secret of your adoption. Let's hear just a clip from Open Secret. Now, you return to your parents' farm to find out more. And you talk to some of your old friends who remember things about your childhood.
Did I talk at all about being adopted with you?
Just said that you were adopted and had no idea who your birth parents were. I remember, I don't know if you remember this, in maybe second, third grade, our plan was to buy a semi, go trucking, and look for your parents while we were working.
I was in this of the school of thought that you can trust your parents, and I knew your parents and I trusted them, but there are parts of it that just didn't seem feasible to me.
We heard first from your friend Vance, who said, we thought we had this fantasy of buying a semi and going looking for your parents. Well, when you came of age, you didn't do that, but what did happen at 18?
Well, at 18, the night before my high school graduation, Vance and Alan, who you both just heard there, they came to my house. They came into my bedroom and Vance said, there's something that we want to tell you. And I was surprised because they were so serious and they weren't really serious guys. And I had no idea what they were about to tell me. And then, Vance said to me, we know who your mother is. And I said, well, who? And they said, your sister. Your sister's your mother. I said, I think I might have asked, which one? I don't even think I
right,
put
you
two
have
and two
several.
Together. Yeah, I have 6 sisters. So, they said, well, Joni is your mother. And then I, from what I remember, which is a little vague, and from what I also, my friends, Alan and Vance both remember, is that I was instantly, incredulous. And then I became sort of contemplative about it and trying to figure it out in my head how this could be possible. But I was shocked. I was very shocked. I had no idea.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, at age 18, everyone's figuring out their identity. But for you, there you were, right about to begin your new life. uncovering these kind of layers of identity or identifying these layers of identity that you had to peel back. And, you know, we heard your mother a little earlier laughing it off. You know, I thought you knew, kind of minimizing a huge revelation that your parents were actually your grandparents. So do you think they got what this meant to you?
No, I mean, I don't. I think ultimately they did in the process of talking to them for the film, which I did over several years and many interviews with them. But initially, no, there was a lot of self-preservation going on here. And I don't necessarily, looking back, I can have this perspective now. I don't really blame them for what they did. It was a very difficult situation at a very difficult time. You know, this is 1969 Kansas in a very Catholic part of the country, and this is not something that you necessarily want to be out there, that your oldest daughter got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of self-preservation going on. But no, I don't think that they understood. You know, and the thing is, how could you understand it unless it actually happens to you? And it's one of these things where the age of 18 is not a great time to learn this information about yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a hugely pivotal moment in your life. And to be leaving high school and moving on to the next part and to have this sort of identity rug pulled out from under you is difficult. I had a hard time dealing with it for a good 10 or 12 years.
Well, I think we sort of watch you grow throughout this process, too. I'm guessing at when some of these conversations, or at least the chronology of some of them, there's one when your adoptive mother, Mary Jane, she responds to your questions about keeping the truth from you. Here's a little clip.
Well, what would you have preferred if you called us grandma and grandpa or mom and dad?
It's not so much that. I wish you would have adopted me and said, by the way, we also happen to be your grandparents. Mm-hmm. But we adopted you because we love you and we want you to be in the family. I always think it's better to tell people that you're family.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. I always think it's better to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And you guys didn't tell the truth.
Well, we just didn't tell. You didn't ask.
Why are you being so stubborn about that point?
It's not lying when we didn't answer. Wasn't asked a question.
But I didn't know to ask about it.
Steve Lickteig is with us. He's a producer for NPR in Washington, now filmmaker, and we just heard a clip from his film called Open Secret. It documents his unraveling a really hurtful family secret that he grew up with, not knowing that his oldest sister was indeed his mother. Steve, it strikes me as so courageous of you, or maybe made me squirm to see her, this now tiny old lady who was described by all of your family as kind of imperious, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
How do you approach resolution when you and she see things so differently?
We never got resolution. That was a very frustrating interview with her. She would not admit that there was any lying. I mean, and I know lying is a very strong word, but that's what happened. But she calls it omission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm not asking, how can they lie? And we never really did reach anything on that. There was no agreement that came from that. It was sort of agree to disagree moment. And that was hard to be sitting there across the table from her as an adult and her as an old, you know, she was in her 80s then.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe she'd have a moment of, you know, you're right. We did keep something from you, and we're sorry, but that didn't happen.
And that moment never comes. And there's the point when your then-fiancé, Barry, very wisely says to you, you know, you might not get the resolution you're looking for. This might not turn out to be the, I don't know, catharsis that you're looking for.
She had really great insight. I mean, I think as only someone from outside looking in could, that I wanted all these threads to be woven together perfectly and for everybody to come together and say, I was wrong, I'm sorry. Not only to me, but to each other, Mary Jane, my mother, to Joni, my birth mother, to have them come together and sort of get their stories aligned. And my fiance, now wife, Barry, just says, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. You need to find a way to move on from that.
We're going to hear a conversation with you and your birth mother, Joni, also your oldest sister. What did you want from her?
I wanted to know a lot of things. I wanted to know what she was thinking when she got pregnant, what her plan was for herself and for me when she found out she was pregnant, and why she felt the need to go along with the plan that my parents had constructed.
And about your father, I think. We learned
and my father, who I didn't find out about him until I was almost 30 years old. I mean, I knew that, obviously Joni knew who he was because she had been with him, but she didn't know anything about him. And I didn't find out about his past until I was 30 years old.
There are several conversations you have with Joni in the film. Here's a clip from just one of them from the film Open Secret.
You're my mother, and I understand that, but you're also my sister. And
no, I'm not your sister.
You are, by law.
No, Yes, you are.
I am not your sister.
Legally, you are my sister.
But biologically, I am not your sister.
Right,
and there's a difference between that. I am sorry.
But we were raised to believe.
Oh, I know you were.
You know, Steve, it strikes me in this film a lot of impasses like this and deeply burrowed resentments, I think, on her part especially. Mm-hmm. You could have been rageful about this, but I'm really struck by your compassion for the players, you know, even though they were so close to you and it was so weighted for you. How did you get there?
It took a while, to be honest with you. I mean, when I said I found out at 18 and then in my 20s were kind of this mess of just keeping everything sort of locked in and not dealing with it. You know, my family didn't talk about this until I came home, 17 or 18 years later with the camera. So we had never discussed this secret as a family. At that point, I was ready to just know the truth. I did not go home and start making this film to bring about accusations. It was simply to uncover the truth, and I used the camera as a way of getting people to take what I was doing seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of worked in the sense that they did take it very seriously and they really wanted to talk, and also to give them a very respectful and professional space to do that talking in. And I was able to get at a lot of reasons, and you know, I uncovered all of these repressions and all of these worries and concerns that I didn't even know existed. I now have such understanding as to why this decision was made and why it was kept from me. I totally get it now. And it took me the process of making the film to get to that point. And listen, there was some, you know, I was angry occasionally, but I tried to not let that show in my interviews. I know that makes for more dramatic mm-hmm. filmmaking, yeah. possibly, but that's not what I tried to do or wanted to do in the making of the film. I wanted it to be a respectful place where people could just tell their story without being told, no, that's wrong, or that you're lying.
How can listeners see the film?
Well, it's one of these incredible stories of documentary filmmaking where there's a slow rollout situation. It's been in a couple of festivals. It's been broadcast in Israeli television. It'll be in Sweden in a few months. And I'm trying to find an American distributor to be able to get it onto DVD.
Well, short of going to Israel or Sweden, we will look out for it. And we really thank you, Steve Lichtai, for a very honest and unflinching film.
Thank you very much.
Steve Lichtai is a producer for NPR, and his documentary is called Open Secret. You can see a trailer at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can follow the link we've posted to find the DVD. We'd like to know if Steve's story brings anything home for you. Should he have left things well enough alone for his aging parents? Are there secrets that you suspect or would like to talk to your family about? You can join the conversation taking place right now on our Facebook page, or if you'd rather, send a note to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Coming up on Word of Mouth, literary respites for the holiday weekend and beyond. We'll turn the page with suggested reads from a book blogger in just a moment. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the turkey is picked clean and you'd rather wash dishes than watch football, fear not. We have some suggested literary escapes for you from Michelle Filgate. She's a writer, critic, book blogger, and well-followed member of the literary Twitterati. She runs events at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn and has never steered us wrong. Michelle, great pleasure to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So what kind of book do you want to pack for Thanksgiving?
I probably most likely a book that allows me to escape during the stressful moments. Not that I don't love seeing my family, but we all have stressful moments with our family.
Holidays with family, I mean, need we say more? Any suggestions for those of us suffering from just pedestrian family dysfunction?
Oh, yes. I have the best book, which is May We Be Forgiven by A.M. Holmes. Mm-hmm. It was published this fall, and it is a great American novel in every sense. And it's also the ultimate dysfunctional family book. It's about a Nixon scholar named Harold, who isn't much of a kid person, and he is basically thrust into taking care of his brother's children after his brother commits a horrible horrible act of violence and kills his own wife after finding her in bed with him.
Oh, my.
Yes. So it's
really makes my
dark.
Family look pale.
Yeah, it's an incredibly dark book, but believe it or not, it's actually hysterical. It's really funny, and it's a book of our times we live in now. There's everything in there from addressing cyber dating, and there's even naked laser tag in the book. And reading it on the subway here in New York City, I found myself laughing out loud so many times that people were looking at me funny. So
that's May We Be Forgiven by A.M. Holmes. And you have really something for everyone here, as usual, a full array. Now, on Thanksgiving, we may have, what, the football crowd? And then, of course, there's the waiting for the end of the world crowd. What have you got for them?
You know, we've seen a trend of a lot of literary fiction writers in the last couple of years writing these post-apocalyptic books or these genre books. And that is the case for Justin Cronin, who a couple of years ago published the first in a trilogy called The Passage, a book that is set in a post-apocalyptic world where the government is testing on prisoners. And something goes horribly wrong, these prisoners are turned into virals, which are basically vampires. And there's one girl named Amy who can save the world. So the first book was this incredibly action-packed book that set up the story. And the second one, called The 12, just came out this October. And it's, I couldn't believe it, it's even better than the first book. And it's definitely a book for fans of The Stand by Stephen King. I think that he draws a lot from that book and is inspired by that book. And my sister, who doesn't usually stay up that late, she has two kids, was telling me that she didn't get much sleep because she just couldn't stop reading it as soon as she picked it up. So,
well, actually, we spoke to Justin Cronin when he got this huge deal to write The Passage. So I'm so glad to hear that it turned out to be a very, very good book.
It's incredible.
Let's hear more for escapism.
So another completely different kind of escapism is Rules of Civility by Amor Towles. It came out in hardcover in 2011, and then the paperback came out this year. And it's my favorite kind of, you know, escapist book, which is a smart escapist book. It's set in New York City, starting out in 1937, and follows this woman who climbs the social ladder in New York. And there's, of course, a romantic angle to this book, and it very much reminds me of Mad Men in a lot of ways because of a woman trying to find her place in that society. And it kind of reminded me of another favorite book of mine, which I read last year, called The Best of Everything by Rona Jaffe, a book that was published in the 1950s and is about women trying to make it in publishing. Both of those books are for the Mad Men fans.
So far, no books on politics, religion, or anything written by TV commentators. Is this the right tack for avoiding any family strife?
At least in my family. Yes. Although there is a book that I have on this list that is nonfiction that is very political. It's called Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. But Catherine Boo, she's long been one of my favorite journalists. She was at the Washington Post for quite a while and is now a staff writer at the New Yorker. This book is just absolutely an incredible work of narrative nonfiction set in India in a makeshift slum near a Mumbai airport. And it follows several people, but it basically opens with a woman who sets herself on fire and blames her neighbors. There's a lot of politics involved in this book in terms of politics in India. But it's also about people trying to make it and survive. And it's absolutely beautiful and heartbreaking as well.
That's Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. We're talking to Michelle Filgate. Her writing has appeared in Salon, Vulture, Time Out New York, The Star Tribune, O, Oprah Magazine, and many other places. And she's giving us some suggestions for books to pack for the Thanksgiving holiday for, let's say, avoiding arguments, getting a little bit of escape. In my family, the tack is, you know, if things get too rough, somebody has to say, I'm going to go into the kitchen and get a fork. We need to have a little bit of fun here, I think, Michelle, though. Given that you are who you are, what have you got in the dark humor bracket?
Skippy Dies by Paul Murray. It's not brand new. It came out, I think, last year or the year before, but it's still one of my favorites. And I know you're a fan, too, right?
I love this book. I actually brought it to Christmas holiday at my in-laws and spent a lot of time sequestered away reading Skippy Dies.
Yeah, Skippy Dies is truly great. It's a book that's set in a boarding school in Ireland, and it's as much about the students as it is the teachers. And it opens with a character choking on a donut and dying. So it's pretty dark in a lot of parts. It also deals with, you know, sexual abuse and a lot of other issues like that. But it's just an incredibly nuanced and all-consuming book that is about youth and about how adults can be as childish as children. And I loved it.
Michelle, I sometimes wonder, you know, do you have any guilty pleasure books? Like, do you have any, even though you kind of fantasize about reading books that aren't sort of brainy and well-written all the time?
Oh, yeah, I totally do. In fact, one of my favorite total escapist books is this, the Outlander series by Diana Gabaldon, which they're turning into a television show, and I'm really excited about that. It's about a woman who is in, right after World War II, she goes to meet up with her husband. She was a nurse during the war, and while she meets up with him, she ends up going back in time and falling in love with a Scottish warrior named Jamie. So she has to choose between her love, who is a Scottish warrior wearing a kilt, and her man in the time she came from. And it's a lot of fun.
Give us some final slices for the bibliophile who likes to steal away with yet another slice of pie and quietly read.
Two of my favorite books this year were published by small presses. One is called My Only Wife by Jacques Jempke, and it follows a man whose wife is missing. And there's kind of a creepy undertone to it. You don't really know whether she left him or whether he got rid of her somehow, but it's him reflecting on his memories of her. And it's very poetic. He talks about how his wife was obsessed with other people's stories and kept a closet where she supposedly, you know, had tapes where she recorded these stranger stories. It's very compelling in a lot of ways. But my other favorite small press book of the year is Glaciers by Alexis Smith and published by Tin House Books. And it's a novel about a librarian who pines after a coworker. There's another book that I wanted to mention that's not escapism. This is literary fiction. It's one of my favorite reads of the year. A friend of mine did write it, but even if she wasn't my friend, I would be recommending this to everyone. And Jonathan Franzen himself blurbed this book, and it's called The Middlesteins by Jamie Attenberg. It's basically about a family in middle America, and this woman, Edie, who's the matriarch of the family, can't stop eating. She's obese, and she's obsessed with food.
And not to mention, overeating seems to be the theme of Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Philgate lives in Brooklyn, where she runs events at Community Bookstore. Her writing has appeared in Salon and Vulture and Time Out New York, the Star Tribune, O, the Oprah Magazine, Book Slut, the Quarterly Conversation, and many other publications. We do have links to more on her recommendations at wordofmouthradio.org. And let us know what you'd pack to survive a family holiday. You can post your titles to the Word of Mouth Radio Facebook page or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth. We've already seen some listener suggestions for books for surviving Thanksgiving with the family. You'll find them, too, on our Facebook page, but here are just a few. Sue suggested Boundaries by Anne Catherine, while Jennifer picked Calvin and Hobbes. For Karen, Long Day's Journey into Night does the trick. I suppose any family who drinks that much will make yours look pretty good. Linda suggested French Kids Eat Everything, a perfect Thanksgiving read, which she says mixes family memoir, humor, and food. We have to mention Gordon, who posted this. I didn't know Valium came in book form. You can add your picks to the conversation going on right now on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Well, whichever elixir or substance you choose for surviving Thanksgiving, be it chocolate, pumpkin pie, mashed potatoes, or a good book, we do hope you have a good one, surrounded by people that you love and who like to eat. I'm Virginia Prescott. On behalf of all of us here at Word of Mouth, we know that your time and attention is precious, and we are truly grateful that you listen. So thanks, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
With web support from Sarah Plord.
Andrew Perella, that's me.
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
Its board of trustees or its underwriters.
That's right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yep.